Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and today we are joined by Daniel Hatcher. Daniel is the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens, published in 2016 by NYU Press. Daniel, welcome.
Hello, Stephen. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk.
So before we turn our attention to talking about the book itself, before we talk about the poverty industry, I wonder if you might say a little bit about your own, your relevant professional experience and background, maybe the kinds of problems that interest you, and then perhaps sort of how you arrived at this particular project.
Sure. Well, I'm currently a law professor at the University of Baltimore, where I teach a variety of classes, including a civil advocacy clinic where I have the chance to continue working with low-income clients in a wide variety of issues. And I try very hard to learn from the ground, so to speak, through my students and through our clients to help inform my advocacy and my scholarship. I think much of my desire to work on these issues stems back to my early work as a legal aid lawyer. My first job at Legal Aid in Maryland, this was about 20 years ago now, was representing foster children in the Baltimore City system here. And it was, to be candid, overwhelming to me in terms of the issues that the children are going through, both before they came to care, while they're in foster care, the struggles when they're aging out of foster care, and the numbers. You know, my caseloads, I represented, I think, my first day in court, 17 children in an afternoon. So, you know, and then from there, I represented adults and about every poverty law related issue you can think of on the civil side of things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, early on, I started experiencing the many difficult circumstances that low-income children, that low-income families and adults go through, the injustices, the inequalities. And then what struck me even more is when I started to encounter ways in which the systems, the agencies that exist to serve these vulnerable populations are sometimes putting their own self-interest above their beneficiaries, right? You know, so that created deep concern for me. And that's really driven, I think, much of my advocacy and is rooted in much of my scholarship over the years, where I've been looking at ways in which state and agency purpose is in conflict with their own self-interest and is causing harm.
That sounds like sort of the perfect segue. So talk a little bit, what do you mean by the poverty industry? And then we'll sort of bore down into the ways in which this plays out on the ground.
Sure. So with the poverty industry, you know, maybe if you step back first, what we normally think of as an industry would be a grouping of companies providing a similar service or product. And mm-hmm. I use an example of the coal mining industry. With the poverty industry, you actually have private companies working in this field of poverty-related funds and programs and services partnering with states and state agencies, right? So the poverty industry includes both the states, the state agencies, and the private contractors, all working around this flow of funds intended to provide assistance to vulnerable populations. And, you know, almost like what you have the coal mining industry, you know, mining ore for coal. With the poverty industry, literally you see practices that feels like, looks like, sounds like mining vulnerable populations, children and the poor, for revenue rather than serving their best interests. Mm-hmm.
So you talk about the way that this plays out across a number of different domains. In general, we've got sort of the foster care system, child support payments, nursing homes, and Medicaid as a couple of broad categories. I wonder if we can maybe work our way through each of those and have you talk a little bit about how this works, how's this function, where is the money coming from, who's gathering it, what are they doing with it, and then maybe some attention to sort of the extent to which this is legal or not. So maybe should we start with foster care?
Sure, that would be great, because that was the initial example that I encountered. Yep. And it's probably what stayed with me the most in terms of what seems like the most stark example of these practices. So the practice I discussed regarding foster children, you literally have state agencies often partnering with private companies to help, that are taking resources from children in their care and diverting the children's funds to general state revenue and private profit. So the way this is happening, I can use Maryland as an example, mm-hmm. where I've sent out several state FOIA requests seeking contract documents regarding these practices.
Yep, Freedom of Information Act requests, for those who may not know.
Right, sorry. So public records requests.
Yeah.
Maryland has a contract with a company by the name of Maximus. And initially, Maximus was doing an assessment for Maryland to determine how many Social Security disability and survivor benefits the agency, the state human service agency, might be able to obtain from foster children in state care. The initial assessment report from Maximus actually describes foster children as a revenue generating mechanism, right? You know, so it's not about how to best serve the children. It's all about the money. But the practice, what's happening is the state agency, with the assistance of a contractor, now Maximus now has a contract statewide in Maryland, is seeking to maximize the number of children who are determined disabled in foster care in order to claim and then take their resulting disability benefits. The current numbers at the time the contract was being initiated was somewhere around 4% of the population as determined disabled for being eligible for Social Security disability SSI benefits for mm-hmm. children. The goal in the contract documents indicated a goal of increasing that percentage upwards to 20% of the foster care population. Not to provide, and this is from the state, you know, goal, not to provide any additional benefits or services related to those disabilities at all for the children, but the state rather simply takes those funds and it ends up in savings to the state general fund. So it goes to general state revenue rather than to helping the foster children. Same thing happens with survivor benefits. And there, you know, the Social Security survivor benefits, the child is eligible if a parent worked, paid into the system and earned those benefits. The state also seeks out children who have dead parents in order to take their survivor benefits. Also, Maryland, other states will even take more. Maryland enacted a regulation where it'll even take pretty much everything from children in their care, at least giving them authority to do so, taking earnings, savings, insurance, you name it. Maryland and many other states will even take veterans assistance benefits from foster children in their care if the parents died in the military. I found an example out of Nebraska. The state will take even more from foster children in their care, even listing burial plots as an example if the child happens to have that as an asset. So obviously, like, once I encountered these practices and started digging into it, I was deeply concerned that, you know, these foster care agencies, that sole reason for existing is to protect and serve the best interests of foster children, is actually taking resources from them. And I've heard arguments repeatedly from the agencies that, well, the agencies are underfunded. And they are. Foster care agencies need more funds to provide better care. But it's nonsensical at best for a foster care agency to take funds from the very children that they exist to protect and serve, to start with. And second, even when the agencies are doing this, when the foster care agencies, when human service agencies around the country, this is a nationwide practice, unfortunately, are taking resources from children in their care like this, it's not leading to more resources for the foster care agencies. Rather, it's replacing state spending, right? So it leads to state savings, to general fund savings, more money for the state general fund, rather than actually more resources to provide care to foster children.
Wouldn't some of those states tell you that in the absence of this revenue coming into the state foster care agencies, that sort of going back into the general fund, that eases some of the budget pressure? So arguably, right, there is in fact more money coming in and being devoted to those children. I mean, is that argument persuasive at all to you?
I have heard, and you're breaking up just a little, I hope I'm clear. I have heard arguments from various agency officials, both and seen them in pleadings. You know, I was involved in litigation here in Maryland on these issues, where they do, you know, make arguments. You know, actually, like the secretary of the Human Services Agency in Maryland, I saw him testify, you know, a couple of years back, saying, almost threatening, that if the agency could no longer take these foster children's funds, that the agency would reduce services to other foster children, right? Legally, that is, and factually, that is incorrect. The states and state human service agencies are required, both under state law and federal law, to provide these services for foster children, and they're required to pay for those services as well. So if Maryland, for example, if the state human service agency here in Maryland were to stop taking children's funds or to help claim funds on behalf of foster children and actually use them to help those individual children as intended, it would not result in less funding to the agency, because the state is legally obligated to provide those funds for the foster care services.
Right. And that legal obligation obviously isn't going to fluctuate either way. So that winds up being rationale for plugging budget holes without having to cut spending in other areas that people may be paying more attention to, or raising taxes in one way or another.
Right. I think that's a good point, because I think the reason this and the other practices that I describe in the book, I think largely one of the reasons this is occurring, these practices that are occurring, is that, you know, the agencies are cash strapped. States are cash strapped. States are, and these are red states and blue states alike, unwilling to raise sufficient revenue through general taxation. So they've been looking for money elsewhere, anywhere they can get it. We've reached a point where foster care agencies are even taking money from kids in their care, right? And they don't even, when they do this practice, they don't, across the country, Maryland, we've had a minor success to help improve this notice requirement, but in other states, they don't even notify the children. They don't notify the children's advocates that they're applying for the benefits, that the state is applying to become representative payee to take over control of the funds. And they don't provide any notice of how they're using the money. And these are the children's funds. It's a horrific practice.
And now, is that possible? I know that you point to some instances in some states in which the foster care agency, which is serving as legal guardian of the child, ultimately winds up having to notify itself of those kinds of particular actions, so that there's nobody else who needs to be engaged legally in making that determination. Is my understanding that correctly, that plays out that way?
Right. And, you know, it's crazy. And this is, I've seen the agencies argue this and you know, multiple cases where they'll say, you know, look, all we're required to do is notify the guardian. We're the guardian,
right?
You know, so we're applying to become representative payee. So we're going to notify ourselves that we're applying to become representative payee, and that's sufficient. We challenged that in Maryland, and I was involved as counsel for a group of advocates that signed on as amici, friends of the court. Mm-hmm. In support of a foster child who challenged his practice. Maryland Legal Aid Bureau was the attorneys for the child. And that went up on appeal to Maryland's top appellate court. And the court did find that the state and the agency was violating foster children's constitutional due process rights by not providing any notice. So hopefully that's now in the process of being fixed in Maryland, but the lack of notice is still happening in other states across the country.
Right. And was that, to the best of your knowledge, was that decision in Maryland based on a reason that could readily be applied in other states, or was it Maryland statutorily or constitution specific?
It could absolutely be applied in other states. It's based on constitutional due process and the practices that are happening under a federal regulatory scheme, and the very similar practices that are being carried out by state agencies all around the country.
Terrific. Well, that's at least arguably a bit of potentially good news down the road at any rate.
I hope so.
Should we turn our attention, talk a little bit about a related but different issue, and that's the diversion of child support payments?
Sure. And you know, this could be impacting the same foster care child. You know, if you think about like a child kind of stepping through these different schemes that could be occurring. And maybe I can describe that at first. You know, much of what we call child support and the back owed child support amounts, the national arrearages that we have for child support are not actually owed to children or their families. Estimates of between a third to half of the total national child support debt, the arrearages, are actually owed to the government rather than the children and their families. And the reason this happens is that both through a framework of federal and state law, the agencies require the initiation of child support orders and when it's foster care against potentially both parents. And then the state takes any child support payments from the children to pay back the state and the federal government for the cost of those foster care services. Yeah. Right. So, again, you could have a child in foster care where the state is actively seeking out and taking the child survivor benefits or Social Security disability benefits, maybe other resources, while they're also pursuing child support that they're taking from the child. I've seen evidence in Maryland and indication in other states that states aren't tracking this, so they could very easily be double dipping, if you will, you know, paying themselves back more than once, mm-hmm. you know, for the cost of care. If you stop and consider the foster care impact, what that does is it layers on an additional financial debt onto low-income parents. Kids come into foster care from poor families, almost always. Yeah. Most of the cases of children in foster care are due to neglect, not abuse. And I'm not saying that there aren't abuse cases, and those are obviously concerning. But most of the children end up in foster care due to neglect. And most neglect is a result of poverty-related circumstances. Yeah. And the initial effort when a child comes into foster care is reunification to try to provide services to the family, to the parents, a parent or both parents, depending on the circumstance. So there can be reunification with the family. But then if you pursue a state-owed debt that they call child support, but it's not going to support the kids, and upon a low-income family where they're struggling to get back on their feet again, that's going to harm everybody involved. Yeah. And I've seen like the numbers I've done in my research trying to look at the financial data. I think it's very likely that states are spending more in enforcement for the state-owed child support enforcement than they're actually collecting. So even if you step apart from the harm that it causes to the children and families, the state is also harmed financially because they're spending more than they're collecting, let alone all the other harm that they're causing to these children, you know, down the road. That also occurs in, you know, what I call the welfare policy, which is our temporary aid for needy families program, yeah. TANF, used to be AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children. If a low-income custodial parent applies for welfare assistance, I'll say she because it's usually the mom, but not always, yeah. as the custodial parent. She's required to initiate a child support obligation against the father. And usually when mom's poor, dad's usually poor too, again, for money that, won't go to help the children. The money is then, taken. It's assigned to the state again, to repay costs of the benefits provided. And that's causing, severe harm across the country as well, both with potentially taking this resource from children, if it was there as a potential resource. Also, there's a good amount of studies over the years that look at what have been called fragile families, and that look at the potential for a healthy relationship between the low-income mothers and fathers, young low-income mothers and fathers, when a child is born out of wedlock. And there's good potential, you know, according to the studies, that the moms, you know, want the custodial parents want the absent parents to be involved. The non-custodial parents want to do their best to provide help and supporting the children. There's potential for Sometimes the relationships to come together, if not in a cohabitation, at least in healthy co-parenting. But when you force poor mom to sue poor dad for money that isn't going to help the child, and again, the state usually can't collect because the parents are poor,
right,
harms everyone involved. And it causes deep harm, and that becomes connected to the criminal justice system for low-income fathers who have these obligations of unpaid, thousands upon thousands of unpaid state-owed child support debts, and their license are suspended. It increases the likelihood that they will work in the underground economy,
yeah,
right, which can cause an increase in criminal activity. So the harm just – It's a domino effect in terms of the harm that's being caused by these practices.
So I mean, you've highlighted sort of irrationality here on, I've lost track of how many different levels in the ways in which this functions in the real world. I mean, is this incompetence and ignorance, or is this malice? I mean, why is this happening in this particular kind of way?
I think that's a great question. It's a hard question. You know, let me start, like, one point I like to make, because in the book, I'm critical of human service agency practices, right? And when they are diverting resources from intended purpose like this. But I think the vast majority of frontline caseworkers want to do good work for their clients, and they're often underpaid themselves and underappreciated and overworked. They have huge caseloads.
Yeah.
So it's happening much higher up, you know, in terms of when these practices, these revenue schemes are occurring. I think our agencies or states, they've lost their way. They've lost sight of the purpose, right? And mission matters. You know, if you have even our state, if you start at the state level, the state government exists to maximize welfare for our citizenry. It doesn't exist to maximize its own revenue, right? And when those two tensions come into head, if the state places more focus on revenue maximization over maximizing the public good, harm will result. And you're seeing that happen with foster care agencies and other agencies that are involved. So I don't think it's ignorance. I think they know what they're doing. I think they've lost sight of what their core mission is. And again, mission matters.
And presumably, given the fact that we are talking about poor and low-income people, almost by definition, in both of these instances, not folks who have a lot by way of political resources or influence in the process. So these become, this is exploitation that you can get away with because you're not likely to face too much by way of pushback, except for underfunded legal aid lawyers who have cases that are too large to keep up with to begin with.
Right. You know, many of these vulnerable populations, you know, these individuals, these children and these low income adults, you know, aren't just now having to deal with these practices from the state agencies. But it's just one barrier after another, after another, after another that they're encountering, including, you know, financial obligations. You know, if they're in court for unpaid credit card debts, in terms of what happens there, court fees and fines. Everywhere they turn, there are more and more barriers put up against them. I'm amazed, you know, when someone is struggling in poverty, if that individual, if that family can truly make it out, it absolutely amazes me. You know, like, you know, personally, I don't think I could. You know, if I grew up in the circumstances of some of my clients that I've worked with, I don't think I'd be able to make it out.
Yeah. And I think most people who don't do this kind of work are not necessarily aware of the sheer weight of force that the state and government, federal government combined, the barriers that they enact to poor and low-income families to not only make it difficult to escape those circumstances, but arguably radically increase the chances that they will remain in those states. But precisely because of some of the dynamics that you talked about, it becomes, you know, poverty winds up breeding poverty in these circumstances. And it's not a force of nature, but it is the power of government applied to them.
Right. No, there are so many systemic barriers that are facing individuals. You know, we all have across the spectrum. We all, you know, ebb and flow in terms of our initiative, right? You know, but for low-income individuals, I mean, they have to be almost superhuman in order to be able to lift themselves out of poverty. And if we talk about foster children again, just briefly, you know,
sure.
foster children aging out of care, they face, the stats are so lined up against these children after already what they've had to deal with in the broken foster care system. The numbers are alarming. You know, like I saw some statistics that by age 26 for former foster care men, I think upwards of like 75% had already been arrested. Right.
Yeah.
The number of foster children who end up homeless, who end up back on public assistance, involved in the criminal justice system. Foster children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at twice the level of Iraq war veterans. You know, these kids are struggling. And then when the systemic barriers are then yet even further in their way as they try to age out of the system, it's unfortunately no surprise that many aren't doing well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I try to stress, another theme I try to stress in the book is that, you know, connectivity, we're all connected. And not just from a philosophical sense. I mean, it impacts us. When a child in West Baltimore is harmed and does worse when he or she ages out of the system, it harms all of us. And not just morally or you know, from the heart, which is important to me, but financially. We all pay the cost when a former foster child struggles and doesn't do well when they age out of care.
So why don't we turn our attention and talk about nursing homes for a little bit, and then we'll conclude by focusing on Medicaid.
Can you ask me that one more time?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I said, why don't we turn our attention to nursing homes?
Sure. And, you know, so if we go to, you know, often the other end of the age spectrum, you know, and this is getting into, a category of revenue screens where I talk about Medicaid generally, but nursing homes, there are a wide variety of concerns. Maybe to start with, the overall lack of quality care in our nursing homes and our country. You know, it is alarming that, you know, in the United States, supposed to be a wealthy country, that nursing home care for our older Americans is on average not in good shape.
Yeah.
Right. And Maryland, as an example, you know, where I live, and teach and practice law, is often, you know, it's state by year by year, it varies, but we're often the richest state per capita. Maryland gets a D grade in nursing home quality of care under some of the various assessment reports. So nursing home care, to start with, is I think to call it horrific in many instances is not an overstatement. And I hope we as a country take notice of that. So these nursing homes, these poor performing nursing homes, are then often used in revenue schemes. States will use the nursing homes as a means to maximize federal Medicaid funds. And then not all states, but many states, I've found examples where I talk about in the book, will then unfortunately divert those federal Medicaid funds away from Medicaid services. Right? They're supposed to be used to provide Medicaid services to the nursing home residents for which they're claimed. We'll divert them instead to general state revenue or to other state use. In the book, I talk about an example in Oregon, you know, where they're using nursing homes and an illusory Medicaid maximization scheme, and then taking those federal Medicaid funds and using it to fund the public education system in Oregon. Now, you know, I'm a fan of public education, but that's not what the way the money is supposed to be used. You know, the state, you know, Oregon is supposed to fund the education system through general taxation, through other means, or through property taxes, however it's going to fund the education system, not by taking federal Medicaid funds from nursing home residents,
yeah.
Right? You know, and there are many examples of that. I grew up in Indiana, and I found an example in Indiana that I discussed in the book where it's a local example. Well, it's both local and statewide. The Health and Hospital Corporation in Indianapolis, which is a municipal agency, discovered that it could buy up for-profit nursing homes. They would actually buy, you know, like the licenses, you know, for these nursing homes, and then often hire the very same companies they bought the licenses from to keep running the nursing homes. But once they were considered to be government-owned, they were able to trigger a higher federal Medicaid reimbursement rate,
yeah.
Right? That's supposed to be used for, again, Medicaid services to those nursing home residents. But rather, the Health and Hospital Corporation of Indianapolis, this municipal agency, is taking all those funds, or the vast majority of those funds, and diverting it to build a new hospital system in Indianapolis. Now, at least that's a healthcare-related purpose. And, you know, that's not how the money is supposed to be used. It's supposed to be used. Medicaid funds claimed on behalf of nursing home residents are supposed to be used for those nursing home residents for Medicaid services. It's not complicated. And this municipal agency in Indianapolis, you know, and that, who then diverted the funds to build a hospital system in Indianapolis, wasn't just buying up nursing homes close to Indianapolis where they're taking the money from. They're buying up for-profit nursing homes all around the state of Indiana, corner to corner, right, in which they were doing this. Indiana gets an F grade in terms of its nursing home quality of care, and it's often been in many different assessment markings been the worst in the country, and like such as examples of staffing levels and the like. So deep concerns in terms of what's happening to our nursing home residents.
And I mean, as a general rule, are these practices are legal, correct?
Well, I would argue no. I think it's a hard question because there's some vagueness sometimes in the regulations and what the language is in the statute. Mm-hmm. But I think the purpose of the Medicaid statute could not be more clear, right? You know, like it's supposed to be developing a partnership. Medicaid is as an example of what I call fiscal federalism, mm-hmm. right? It's shared governance and financing between the states and the federal government. If I use Maryland for example, if Maryland spends $50 of state money on Medicaid eligible services, Maryland can then claim an additional $50 from the federal government in matching funds, and that's so you're supposed to have $100 total then for Medicaid services. So the Medicaid statute, the Medicaid program exists for the purpose of enhancing the ability of states to provide medical care for low-income individuals, matching state spending with federal spending. So when the states divert these funds from intended purposes, that is in direct conflict with the entire purpose of the Medicaid statute. Some of this, unfortunately, has been allowed to occur, you know, by our federal agencies, such as the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Yeah. There have been times the agency has tried to crack down on the practices, and then sometimes the states will very quickly develop a new way of doing this. And some of it has to do with monitoring capacity, you know, simply like the ability to track how much the states are engaged in these practices, and following the money can be hard at times. So. I think there are arguments that some of the practices are illegal. I think there are also examples where we definitely need to tighten up and make more explicit federal statutory and regulatory language.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's when you talk to people about fraud in social welfare programs or Medicaid fraud, this is, I would wager, not what comes to people's mind, right? They think about individuals who are trying to scam the system and get benefits to which they are not entitled. And such things do happen, but the research that we have available tells us that they don't happen an awful lot, and those funds don't amount to too much. But the kinds of patterns that you are describing are large-scale activities undertaken by state governments, often in concert with large private corporations, that are beholden to those state governments, sometimes on both ends of the equation, right? That they are hired on the one hand with a contract to go out and maximize revenue, and then hired by the federal government on the other hand to then evaluate what's going on in those states. Can you talk about a little bit about the way in which that sort of piece of this profit-making enterprise plays out?
Sure. And those are great points and great question. I mean, this is enormous first in terms of the scale, unfortunately. You know, with the foster care revenue schemes I discussed about regarding Social Security benefits that are being taken from children, the only estimate I've seen in terms of the national amount that's happening is from the Congressional Research Service, estimated around $250 million, $250 million each year that are being diverted, taken from foster children. Yeah. In the country. So that's an alarming number to start. But for Medicaid revenue maximization and diversion set strategies, we're talking billions that are being diverted from intended purpose. But you're absolutely right. You know, like most of the times when people think of fraud in the federal aid programs, they're thinking about individuals who are engaged in bad acts. Yeah. And I use an example, you know, in the book, there is a case out of Westchester, New York, where a case, criminal charges were brought against a social worker who had gained access to a foster child's, former foster child's savings. This individual, this child's biological parent had died, and then she was adopted, and then the adoptive mother unfortunately died of cancer, right? And while the mother is dying of cancer, apparently the social worker discovered, that there were these savings of the survivor benefits that the child had received from the biological parent, about $16,000. The social worker took the money, right? And she was criminally charged, and there were notices put out, press releases. We're going after the bad person, in terms of doing this. The county, is saying we're going after that. But meanwhile, that county, Westchester County, has been engaged in private contracts to take survivor benefits, not just from one foster child, but from all foster children who have survivor benefits who are in state care, who are in county care, and also the disability benefits. And there, the county isn't just taking $16,000, taking tens of thousands of dollars from foster children. But no one has been up in arms yet about those practices.
Yeah.
There's an example I talk about. There have been sometimes False Claims Act claims brought under some and some of the claiming practices that occurs. One of the companies I discussed in the book, Maximus, there were False Claims Act brought against Maximus, and I think it's back in 2006 or 2007, regarding a contract with the District of Columbia, where the company was helping Washington D.C. To maximize Medicaid claims, a certain form of Medicaid claims on behalf of foster children.
Mm-hmm.
There were False Claims Act proceedings brought, I believe criminal and civil, and the Department of Justice got involved, and Maximus agreed to a deferred prosecution agreement. So the case settled, agreed to pay back, over $30 million for these claims where there was alleged Medicaid fraud that occurred. So after the settlement agreement, within just a short amount of time after the settlement of alleged Medicaid fraud claims against Maximus, Maximus lands a contract with the state of New York to help run New York's statewide Medicaid fraud program, right? And then a short time after that, Maximus re-ups, continues the contract with the District of Columbia for that very same contract for which it initially got into trouble. Within a short time after that, Maximus either renews or lands new contracts with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, for over $200, $300 million worth of contracts. And this is the federal agency to which the alleged fraudulent Medicaid claims had been submitted, right? And then a short time after that, Maximus lands a contract with the Department of Justice itself, the U.S. Department of Justice, to help run the software to initiate and run the criminal investigation software systems for the Department of Justice, I believe what the contract indicated.
To play devil's advocate there for a little bit, I mean, is part of what's possibly going on there, and this went on in the early implementation of the Affordable Care Act and setting up the exchanges, it goes on in the Defense Department all the time, that because of the nature of these contracts, it requires such specialized technology and skills and expertise and the ability to scale up that it is simply there are a finite number of companies that we can turn to if we're going to outsize source this. So inevitably, even if in a more charitable view, it still is, Maximus is going to have to wind up doing this work anyway. What do you make of that argument?
Well, and I think that's a big and layered question, and we could talk a long time about, like I say, just privatization generally within the world of poverty related aid programs, both at the state level and at the federal level.
Yep.
And in the book, I'm not really going after privatization or assessing is privatization good or bad. No, I have my own views on that. And most of the data and most of the examples that have come out have shown time and time again that privatization causes more problems, is more costly, more inefficient than when it's done by the government in terms of when these programs are carried out. But, you know, I another point I try to stress, you know, like if you think about even the contracts like with Maximus that Maryland has, where the company is helping Maryland maximize the number of claims and seek to obtain, help the state obtain Social Security disability and survivor benefits from foster children. It's the state who's deciding to take those funds from children, right? It's the governor's office who's deciding, you know what, after Maximus helps increase claims for these benefits on behalf of foster children, it's the governor's office who's saying, we're going to take the money from kids. Right. You know, Maryland could use this contract with Maximus to do some good for foster children, to do a lot of good for foster children, you know, for children who are disabled or have deceased parents, to help get these needed federal aid benefits that could then actually, that are entitlements. These are monies that belong to the foster children once they claim, they're claimed. The children could then use their own funds, you know, those Social Security disability and survivor benefits to help themselves.
Yeah.
You know, including conserving the funds for their transition out of foster care. But instead, the state is just taking the money and from kids, and it's causing deep harm.
Yeah. So what do we do about it?
Well, I mean, at the simplest level, you know, stop doing bad stuff, right? You know, like, you know, some of the solutions, when you get down to the crux of it, aren't really complicated. Children's foster care, foster children's funds should be used to help those foster children,
right?
You know, disability benefits for a foster child are supposed to be able to provide additional care and services for those child's needs related to the disabilities, you know, like in terms of their needs. Child support is supposed to be used to support children, not supposed to be taken from children. Medicaid funds are supposed to be used for Medicaid services. So, you know, the crux of it is fairly simple. The hard thing is, how do we get there?
Right.
And I lay out in the book, you know, many different examples. Some of it can be through litigation, as we talked about earlier, regarding claims that can be brought against state human service agencies or the foster care agencies when they're obtaining monies from children. Legislation is possible. I've worked on both legislation here in Maryland at the state level and at the federal level, and there's been a bill introduced not too long ago by a congressman out of Illinois, Danny Davis, that would protect foster children's resources and prevent these practices where the states are taking children's Social Security disability and survivor benefits. And then those funds would actually be conserved for the foster children and what are now called 529A plans. These are plans much like college savings account, 529 plans, but there's a new, relatively new account that's available for disabled children who receive Social Security disability benefits. They can be conserved in what are called 529A plans that have the same tax benefit as the college savings plans, but can actually be used for much expanded reasons, including college or just about any need for the disabled child related to the disability, including working towards becoming independent, right? And they're also, they would be exempt from various asset limits that can apply to the SSI benefit. So it's a wonderful fit. It's there right now that's available where foster children's funds can be conserved in these plans. We just have to stop the states from taking their money. You know?
I mean, it gets back to the sort of the big unfair question. How do we get, I mean, it is not in states' financial interest to do that at the moment. Right. There's a source of revenue that they can use to plug gaps in the budget and avoid all kinds of complicated political challenges by doing this without really facing too much by way of cost, if they can live with the sort of the moral and the ethical consequences. I mean, have you got any sort of insight other than, you know, sort of the slow grind of litigation and to force them into compliance as a way to put pressure on states to at least take the 529 option and enforce it?
Sure. You know, and I know this may sound a little vague, but I think the best way to apply pressure is through awareness. You know, awareness matters, and the states have been able to do this across the country largely because people haven't known.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't notified, you know, the children or their advocates. Most people have no idea that this is occurring across the country, and the vast majority of people, when I talk to them about these practices, they're disgusted by it. You know, it's hard for a state agency official to defend these practices when they're actually talking about it. You know, like, and they would rather not. these practices. So awareness, you know, can be probably the best tool. So what you're doing now, you know, this show and bringing these, you know, to the attention of the public, I think is a huge service. And then, you know, litigation can be of assistance. There's legislative changes that can be done if the agencies won't stop this practice themselves. And I have examples of, you know, model legislation. You know, if anybody ever wants to discuss possible litigation strategies or legislation strategies, I would love to do that.
Terrific. You're listening to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and we've been talking with Daniel Hatcher, the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. So, Daniel, before we are getting to the end of our time here, so before we wrap up, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about anything else that you think we've sort of left unsaid about the book that you want to make sure that you bring to our listeners' attention, and then B, if you could talk a little bit about what are you working on now? What are the things that you either in your professional or your academic capacity you're focusing on?
Sure. Well, I guess I can say there's, you know, a couple other examples. I won't get into a lot of detail, but in the book where I also talk about like school-based Medicaid claims are sometimes unfortunately literally being taken from poor disabled school children. New Jersey is doing this under the current administration. In New Jersey, the state requires school districts to participate with a revenue maximization contractor. And then right in the governor's budget documents, the state will take over 80% of the school-based Medicaid claims from poor disabled school children instead of using it for general state revenue. There's also many examples, you know, then it expands into what's happening where even the courts have gotten involved in the revenue generating schemes, right? You know, in terms of fines and fees that are layered upon poor litigants, that, you know, $500 in fines and fees can quickly escalate into, you know, a few thousand. And then the courts will hire private collection agencies to get involved, which will layer more money in terms of their services on top of that. And it just creates even more barriers in terms of even the return of what have been determined called debtor's prison. People litigants literally locked up for being poor, you know, and unable to pay the debts. In terms of what I'm going to work on going forward, I'm sort of figuring that as I go. You know, and what I realized with this book is every issue I started to dig into just unsurfaced more and more examples. Unfortunately, you know, where I feel like I've exposed a lot, you know, in the book, but I've also on one level just scratching the surface of examples in which the government agencies, whether it's a state level or local level, have put their own financing above the best interests of either the vulnerable beneficiaries in the aid programs or to the citizenry as a whole.
Yeah.
So one of the things I thought about is maybe looking more at a city level example to look at, you know, following the money and maybe following an individual through the various systems that are impacted by the city's application of the various systems that can impact an individual, and then trying to follow the money in terms of how the money is actually used within a city system. And I'm in a city in Baltimore where poverty, unfortunately, is a huge issue. And, you know, so it would be an interesting city to use as an example for that.
Yeah. Fascinating and horrifying.
Agree. Yeah. So, I'm you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, I do think change is possible. And I think with increased awareness that we can fix these systems. You know, I encounter a lot of bad practices out there. But at the same time, I think it's possible, again, through increased awareness and through really trying to put more pressure on our government officials to be true to, you know, their purpose. I think most people want to do good stuff, right? You know, it's just they've lost their way.
Yeah.
You know, I talk a lot about that. You know, I use the term vulnerable in the book frequently, but we're all vulnerable, right? You know, and if we can get back to that simple point and remember that we're all vulnerable, we're all connected. You know, I know that sounds a little touchy-feely, but you know, that's important to remember that we're all in this together. And when the government is running a program that is harming a vulnerable population, it's harming all of us.
Yeah. And we all have a stake if you know, sort of funds that we sort of collectively through our elected representatives have decided to allocate for one particular kind of public purpose and they are being misused and misallocated, that does a disservice to all of us. I mean, that's sort of a fundamental violation of the compact that theoretically we make with each other. So I'm right there with you. And I appreciate the hopefulness. I think also that it's sort of important for you to that you talked about the ways in which when confronted with these kinds of contractual arrangements and these behaviors on the part of states, it is exceedingly difficult for officials to defend them out loud, and that part of what makes it possible for these practices to happen is that people don't know that they're happening.
Right. I completely agree with you on that.
Thank you so much, Daniel. We've been talking with Daniel Hatcher. He's the author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens, published in 2016 by NYU Press. Daniel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Stephen.